Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. Salon at 615 is recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Hi. Hello, room. Hello, overflow room. Thank you all for coming. It's very, very touching. I'm walking around with my purse because I have a cold, and in the middle of the reading, I'm going to want to get all my Kleenex together. I feel like I just want to thank everyone who's here. First and foremost, I want to thank the library. And if this is someplace you are often, welcome back. We love having you here. If this is someplace that you come rarely and you're coming here to see me tonight, look around, become a friend of your library, support your public library. This library bears up so much of the weight and responsibility of this city, and they're really here for you and for a lot of people who aren't here tonight, and we all just need to remember them and support them. So I'm a big champion of my library. My Van Devenders are here tonight, I think, maybe. Hi, Van Devenders, who I love. Love you both. Really glad you're here. And my parents are here, and my dear friend Nikki Castle, who probably has given up her seat to someone, is also here. Anyway, I could go on and on. What I always think about when I am reading in Nashville is the night that I started book tour for Patron Saint of Liars. I'm going to stay away from that microphone. When I was 27 years old, I think. I'm 47, so that was a long time ago. And the first stop on book tour was Davis Kidd. And I sat in the parking lot of Davis Kidd. I drove myself over, and I sat in the parking lot of Davis Kidd before I was supposed to go in and cried, because I was so terrified just to walk in the door and start the beginning of this life that has brought me here tonight. And it's a lot easier now, and I'm not sitting backstage and crying. But oh, it used to be so different then. It used to be when I went on tour for Patron Saint and Taft, and even Magician's Assistant, but definitely for Patron Saint and Taft, they gave me $3,000 and I did 25 cities in the car. And I kept my nice dress in the trunk of the car, and I would drive to Indianapolis and go to the McDonald's and put my dress on and go to the bookstore, and there would be no one there. And I mean, I don't mean like no one like I'm being modest. I mean like the people who were selling books were there in the store. And back in those days, they really told authors that the point of a book tour when you were young and starting out was to go and meet the booksellers. And so the idea was you would just go and kind of make nice with the girl who was at the cash register in hopes that maybe after you left that she would read your book and then hand sell it to other people. And it was actually, it worked out very well for me, because back then I was a contributing editor for Bridal Guide, but actually I was Bridal Guide. I had about 7 pin names and I wrote the whole issue. And what I found to be a universal truth in these bookstores was that the girl at the cash register was always about to get married, or she really wanted to get married. And so I would go in night after night, and this was book tour, and talk to these young women about what kind of engagement ring they really wished they'd gotten, or whatever the issue was. And then I would go home. It was a beautiful country, and it still is a beautiful country, although in the bookselling scene, it was much different. I'll also, without anyone knowing who I was, I got book reviews in St. Louis and New Orleans and Denver and places that I never even went to, because people, all these papers had book review sections, and so they were there also for the young author. And the point of this story is I wonder sometimes how it's going to be, because as a young writer, sometimes I feel like I had the last great career. Because a young writer can't just go around on the cheap to independent booksellers anymore. The people that they're bringing in now are people like me. And all of these review sections that were such a huge part of American newspapers have also gone away. And the notion of kind of going into bookstores and looking around and judging a book by its cover, you know, picking a book up and saying, I like the way this looks, flipping it over, reading the flap. We've all had that experience, reading a review of something that you'd never heard of and thinking, that sounds like such a great book, I'm going to read it. And all of those things are getting a little more diffuse, a little tougher, and I've been really so aware of all of that as I have been going around, and let me tell you what, I have been everywhere. I have been absolutely to every bookstore that is still standing, I think, in America in the last month. And what I know more and more for sure as I do this is that this is a city that needs a bookstore. And this is a city... Yeah. And that I know that you guys are going to be there. And thanks to my partner and friend and the person who's so much smarter about this than I am, Karen Hayes, we're going to make this happen. My friends Steve and Judy Turner were walking up from downtown, and they passed someone on the street, and they said, where are you going? And they said, oh, we're going to hear Ann Patchett read. And they said, oh, tell her I hope she really opens this bookstore. So I feel like the word is quite literally on the street. You know, it's out there. And I've had such an outpouring of love and support, as has Karen, and excitement. And we'll talk about that again at the end of the evening. But there's going to be, well, actually, let me say it now, just in case I get spacey and forget. But there's going to be a sign-up sheet outside. If you want to get information, if there's some way you feel like you could participate, I can't believe I'm going to utter this sentence, but sign up for the Facebook page, I, who have never looked at Facebook in my life, and will go to my grave without looking at it. yay! Parnassus Books, which is the name of the store, P-A-R-N-A-S-S-U-S, Parnassus Bookstore. We have a presence on Facebook, and we're going to have a website up and running soon, and I'm saying we as if I was putting it up on Facebook, but Karen is the brains behind all of this. But it's going to be a great way to keep getting the word out. So we want you to sign up, and we want you to send that out to your friends just so we can have as much grassroots support in the community as we can. When I was growing up in Nashville, I went to St. Bernard's from first grade through 12th grade back in the days when you could do that. And I started first grade in 1969. And when I got out of school at the end of the day, every day, my sister and I would walk over to Mills Bookstore. And I can remember coming back to Davis Kidd and meeting Stephanie Freudenthal, who looked at me and said, I remember you. You were that 8-year-old. I remember you. You were that little girl. And I think that that's exactly the model that I want to go back to. I want to have a store where we know you and we know what you're reading and we know what you like and we know what to recommend to you. And I will not let this evening end without recommending books to you, believe you me. People in the other room, if you have any questions, there will be somebody in the other room to give them to, and they will be brought into this room so we can definitely field questions. So here I am in Nashville. It's kind of fun to be here later in the game instead of opening up here. I'm just kind of got my act more together, so to speak. The book is called State of Wonder, and it's about a tribe in the Amazon. I've now boiled it down to that sentence. That's what happens. Like, when you first go out, it takes you about 10 minutes to say what the book is, and then by this time it's like, it's a book that takes place in the Amazon. That's really all you need to know about it. And I don't know why it just occurred to me to tell you this story that I wanted to tell you. So many strange things have happened, and I'm not losing my mind. I am going to come back around to it. But there have been all of these interviews and all of these weird things that have happened along the way. But my favorite is I was interviewed by the Wall Street Journal, and at the end of the interview, the woman at the Wall Street Journal said to me, okay, what I really want to talk to you about is your pet raccoon. And I said, excuse me? Because I thought I must have misunderstood. She said, your pet raccoon. I said, I don't have a pet raccoon. And she said, you do. You have loads of raccoons. They live in your house. I know this. I've read about it. I said, no, actually, I'm really sort of afraid of raccoons because I was charged by a raccoon on my back porch last summer and it scared the bejesus out of me. And I give raccoons a really wide berth. It's just all by way of saying there are a lot of misconceptions out there. And I said, please, please publish this part of the story. Please tell people that I don't live with raccoons, that it's not Grey Gardens over at my house. But, you know, then they don't, and those things are never corrected. But that's the other thing about coming home. It's the one place that I feel like I can say, you guys don't think I live with feral raccoons. You know me better than that. It's really comforting. I just keep looking up and seeing all these people I know, and I think you know that I don't live with raccoons. Okay, so back to the book. That's what we're here for. So this book about the Amazon, which I hope none of you listened to Michael Feldman's What Do You Know last weekend, and if you did listen to it, put it permanently out of your mind. He gave away the ending of the book. It was horrifying. If you could kill another person on live radio 1,000 miles apart, I would have done it with telekinesis or something like that. The scene that I'm going to read is 15 minutes long. If you have a copy of the book and you know where it is, don't read along because it really freaks me out. There are 5 people on a pontoon boat. It's 15 minutes, but it goes really fast. There are 5 people on a pontoon boat, and 3 of them are American doctors, Dr. Mirena Singh and Drs. Alan and Nancy Saturn. Now, and there are also 2 members of the Lakashi tribe, Benot, who's 20 years old, wants to be a tour guide, doesn't speak English, and Easter, who is 11 or 12 and is profoundly deaf. 2 more tangents. 1, Alan and Nancy Saturn. You guys know. Alan and Nancy, my beloved neighbors. If you open my front door and look out my front door, you are looking into Alan and Nancy Saturn's, oh, bless you.
Thank you.
And she even opens it for me. This is a best friend, ladies and gentlemen. Alan and Nancy Saturn are people that I had known my whole life, and very fortunately were my neighbors. And while I've been on book tour, it's been so great. I swear, every city, practically every city I've been in, somebody has come up to me and said, I knew Alan and Nancy, no matter where I was. Their impact of love and goodness and light really went all across the country. But after Alan died, I was over with Nancy one afternoon, and I was working on this book, and I said, would you and Alan like to be characters in the book? Just, you don't have to answer now, just think about it. And she said, I don't have to think about it. I said, they won't be you. It won't be your personality. It'll just be your names. Do you want to be in the book? She said, yes, we definitely want to be in the book. So that's, I think for Nashvillians, it can be a little distracting because there are a lot of Nashvillians in this book. But that's a nice thing. It's turned out to be a really nice thing. The other thing that I want to tell you is about the character of Easter, who is deaf. And the way that happened is when I was on book tour for Run, I was giving a talk in the Washington National Cathedral, and actually had 3 really kind of amazing magical things happen that night in the signing line, which went on for about 3 hours. But one of the things that happened is a woman came up to me, and I had been giving a talk that had in part to do with Run, and I said, it was very important for me in that book to write a book in which there were characters of different races and it wasn't about race. There were just people of different races who happened to be inhabiting the same novel. And this woman came up to me and she said, I'm an interpreter for the deaf, and I would really like to see a book in which there is a deaf character and it's not a book about being deaf. And nobody talks about it or wrings their hands about it. He's deaf. We all move on. I said, I can do that for you. And so if there's anything that you'd like to see in future novels, please let me know. The other thing I need to tell you about this scene, for reasons I've never been able to figure out, but probably has something to do with the 12 years that I spent at St. Bernard's, I can't swear in public. And I write books in which there is virtually no swearing and almost no one has sex, and there's usually a moral, and that's why they are so often taught in colleges. And in this scene that I'm going to read, it's the one scene in which there is, in fact, a great deal of very emphatic swearing. But because I can swear one-on-one if you want to come up individually, but I can't swear to the group. So just channel that while I'm reading. Just swear to yourselves quietly. And the last thing I want to tell you, I was in Toronto 2 weeks ago, and I was going through customs. And I went up to the customs agent, and he said to me, how long are you going to be in Canada? And I said, I'm going to be in one night, because I'm every place, one night. He said, why? I said, I'm going to be at the Luminata Festival. He said, what are you going to be speaking about? My new book. What's it called? State of Wonder. What's it about? The Amazon. Are you a botanist or an anthropologist? I said, I'm a novelist. He said, have you gotten your Sunday New York Times review? I said, next week. He said, how is it? I said, just okay. He said, are there snakes in your novel? I said, yes. Yes, in fact, there are loads of snakes in my novel. And the customs officer said to me, I hate snakes. I'm not going to read your novel. And then he goes like this, which is the universal sign for, we are no longer interested in speaking to you. So, this one goes out to the customs officer in Toronto's airport. They had not passed another living soul since they left the Jintas, and the world seemed something silent and wide, belonging only to them. On the left, there was what appeared to be a crisp green field of floating lettuce. Bennett tapped at Easter's arm, and the boy turned the wheel and took them in. Beneath the sound of bird calls, there was the most delicate sound of crunching, as if the boat were making its way through a lightly frozen pond in December, and the ice, half the thickness of a window pane, was breaking apart to let them pass. Morena leaned over the front of the boat to watch the lettuce compact beneath the pontoons, while behind them the plants knitted themselves back together, smoothing over the path they had made without so much as a single damaged leaf. We are here, Morena thought, and we were never here. It was a green so much brighter, so much fresher than anything she'd seen in the jungle. Long-toed birds strolled across the delicate meadow with such confidence, it was tempting to think that those tiny floating plants might hold the weight of a single pharmacologist. The question, then, was whether or not the water was a foot deep or 20 feet deep. Bennett smacked at Easter again and held up his hand, and Easter stopped the boat. Bennett laid down on his belly then, his head and shoulders over the side. He had seen something. The Saturns came and leaned over him. Morena leaned over him. Is it a fish? Nancy said. Pexy? Bennett shook his head. I don't see anything, her husband said. Easter kept his eyes on Bennett, who, without looking at his captain again, pointed his hand to the left, to the right, a little back. Easter held the throttle low and scooted the big boat around in the smallest possible increments until Bennett, every ounce of his attention fixed to the sweet spring of lettuce, abruptly raised his hand, and Easter killed the engine altogether. The silence was startling. The budding naturalist, still flat on his stomach, then dove that same hand down through the leaves and began to pull the colossus of all snakes onto the boat. Human instinct dictated first that the snake must be kept away from the face. And so Bennett straightened his arm to rigid as if wishing to cast it away from his body while holding on too tightly for the snake's comfort. The reptile's long, recurved teeth snapped ferociously into the air, diving towards Bennett's wrist while Bennett whipped the head from side to side, buying time until he could close the distance between hand and head. He rolled onto his side and then his back, managing somehow to pull the first half of the reptile on board, where it flailed like a downed electrical wire. At its neck, the snake was as big around as Bennett's wrist. And from there, its body, smooth scales of darkest green with black blotches on the back and then creamy light underneath, swelled into a size more in keeping with his thigh. The snake kept pulling up and pulling up, more and more of itself slithering up and onto the deck in thick, muscular rolls where it sought its way onto Bennett's body, extending out against him, kneading him, while Bennett struggled mightily to keep their two faces apart. Do not let the faces touch. Put it back, Nancy screamed in English, the language that stood between Bennett and his dreams of becoming a tour guide. Drop it. Snake, Alan Saturn said, and then repeated the word endlessly for good measure. He had caught it, sure enough, but he hadn't caught it close enough to the head. There was too much available snake above Bennett's hand, and the snake's enormous, gaping mouth sought purchase, its jaws opening wider than such a little head should reasonably dictate. In a flash, there was evidence of many rows of smaller teeth lined up and waiting to clamp onto skin. Only by swinging it wildly did he keep the snake from sinking into his wrist. Bennett seemed fixated only on the 6 inches of snake between the top of his fist and the tip of its tongue, while completely ignoring the enormous body that was working its way heavily onto his own body now. And Bennett, who was wet with sweat and the water that the snake had brought on board, was laughing. There, on his back, pinned like a wrestler in an unsporting match, he roared with a powerful joy while he tried to work one hand upwards with the assistance of the other hand. Easter, ever helpful, grabbed the lower half of their guest off his friend and pried it away. There was too much coiling and uncoiling for an accurate measurement, but the snake appeared to be 15 feet long, 18 when it stretched. Bennett appeared to be 5 feet, 5 inches, and he was outweighed by as much as 50 pounds. The three doctors pressed away, screaming various invectives in an unhelpful language. Moreno wanted to jump in the water and run across the lettuce with the long-toed birds, but who's to say that a snake didn't have a family down there? There was an odor that none of them recognized, the smell of furious reptile, an oily stench of putrid rage that sank into the membranes of their nostrils as if it planned to stay there forever. The back half of the snake whipped up and made itself a knot around Easter's slender waist and wrapped, and at the moment that its head swung past, Easter reached into the air, his hand a quarter second faster than the snake, and grabbed the throat well below the head, well above Bennett's fist. Easter had caught the snake that Bennett had caught. Oh, the whooping, the triumph, and the revelry. They shook the jungle with their screams, Bennett and Easter, for sure enough, Easter was screaming, and the sound was so piercing, so much like the agony of death, that all three doctors lunged forward with the instinct to save his life. But Easter was grinning madly as he gripped the snake, while Bennett, who was considerably stronger, held fast below. They looked into the creature's mouth now like a carnival attraction, while the tongue, a silvered spark of light, licked towards them. It's an anaconda, Alan said. He caught an anaconda with his hands. Alan Saturn seemed to be at the perfect intersection of the thrilling achievement of the Lakashi, the terror of Morena and his wife, and the rage of the snake whose eyes were focused into two pinpoints of murderous desire. Easter coughed. Maybe Morena understood it before he did, but of course that would be impossible to say. In a minute, everything was clear to her, and she stepped through the wall of her own revulsion and fear and took the tail end of the snake that was pressed into Easter's hip. Its flesh was at once clammy and dry, cool despite the terrible heat of the day. She had once dissected a snake in a college biology class, a small black garter snake long dead and stinking of formaldehyde. She'd cut it down the center and pinned it open on a wax-bottom pan. To the best of her memory, it was the only snake she had ever touched. She touched the second one as she worked to pull it loose from the boy. When she had pried a little of it away, she moved her hands up the body, hand over hand, like she was working her way up a rope, except the rope began to wrap around her wrist. It was a muscle like nothing she had ever encountered before. It did not fight against her. It did not notice her. She pulled. Easter coughed again. Bennett could see the problem now as well. His friend was wrapped inside the snake, and the snake had figured out a way to loosen the hand that held its neck. Bennett slid his hand up to cover Easter's hand just as Easter's hand fell away. Easter tried to work his own small hands in between himself and the snake, and when he exhaled just to get his fingertips in between them, the snake felt the movement of his breath and squeezed. Easter's eyes shot first to Morena, and there she saw the very soul of him in his fear. And she pulled, and Alan's hands were by her hands, and they were pulling together, all of them, Bennett from the throat, while Nancy Saturn cried for a knife, a knife, and then Jacques. But Bennett could not hear her now. He was frozen to the snake, who was in the business of killing his friend, who may have been 11 or 12, but was very small for his age. "Tell me there is a knife on this boat," Nancy said. Easter's lips were turning blue, either from the lack of oxygen or the weight of the snake. He went down on his knees. It occurred to Morena that his spine could snap. They all went down on their knees. Morena knew there was a machete strapped to the steering column of the boat, the knife that Easter had used to trim away the branches when they tied the boat to a tree, and in an instant she was up. The knife was nearly as long as her arm, heavy as a tennis racket, and she put the blade just above Bennett's fist and with a single pass sliced off the head. And it would have been the greatest moment of her life had cutting off the head killed the snake. But beheading changed nothing. On the deck, the busy head continued to snap its murderous teeth, moving in a slow circle as the jaw opened and closed while its body went about the business of strangling the boy. "Jesus," she said. She could see the tendons standing out on Bennett's neck. She could see his crooked bottom teeth, his open jaw jutting forward in exertion, the blood of the headless snake running down his arm. While Bennett continued to pull the top of the snake, the Saturns continued to pull the bottom, and in the middle, Easter continued his death. Morena began to saw into the rolls of headless snake, her hand at Easter's head, the point of the machete at Easter's toes. Her objective was to cut through both coils simultaneously, as she doubted there would be time to do this twice. At no point did Easter make a sound. He would not use another teaspoon of his breath. He stayed stock still inside this jacket and kept his eyes on Morena. First, there was a large vertebral column that required Morena to lean in as she sawed, as much as she would have leaned in to saw apart a human wrist with a long knife at a bad angle. She had worried about pressing in too hard and cutting into Easter, but Easter was still very far away. She cracked the vertebra in the first coil and then worked the knife from side to side to break the second bend. She then cut through the ribs, the thick muscles that ran down the belly scute, the cloquea. When she was very close to Easter, she put the knife down and ripped the bit of snake that was left with her hands. The heavy weight of the snake worked in her favor then, tearing itself as it fell to the deck. Nancy Saturn picked the boy up, light as air, this child, and stretched him out beside his murderer and blew into his mouth and blew her lips reined in to cover so small a mouth. With one hand behind his neck, she tilted back his head, and with the other, she blocked his nose and blew until she saw his chest rise, and none of them could tell whose breath it was, and so she stopped, and it was his. Shallow and uneven at first, but his own. She lifted up his shirt and lightly touched the red welts on his torso, and Alan Saturn needled beside her and put his ear to Easter's chest. Benoit crouched away from them, his head against his knees, his back heaving with his breath, while on the other side of the boat, Easter's eyes blinked. Morena sat down beside him then in the pool of widening blood and took his hand. It was still daylight when they got back. Alan Saturn was driving the boat, and even though there were a couple of dozen Lakashi waiting on the shore, the branches that they held in their hands had not been lit. They saw the boat and stood up to watch, but they didn't jump or cry out. It could have been because the travelers had only been gone for half a day, and it could have been because Dr. Swenson was not among them. Either way, everyone on the boat was relieved, though there was more to celebrate now than there had been in all their lives combined. But when Alan Saturn pulled the boat up next to the little dock and the Lakashi came on board, the calling and the crying broke forth in earnest, not the theatrical display of a week before, but a deep and abiding joy that Morena had not seen. Three men picked up the three large chunks of snake from the blood-slicked deck, and a fourth man picked up the head, the very head Morena had meant to kick into the water, though she had been unwilling to touch it again, even with her foot. They carried off the pieces of snake, each as heavy as a small tree, and hoisted them above their head to show the ebullient crowd. It would be a feast to tell the grandchildren about for years to come. There would be anaconda for dinner tonight. Thank you. And I'm reading that thinking, I'm making it all the way through without blowing my nose. This is astonishing. I'm going to tell you a story, which I have told, but you may have heard it on the radio, you may have heard me say it someplace, because I am repeating myself, but there is a better version of it, which is this version. So, Carl, my husband, and I went to the Amazon to do research for this book when I was about halfway through, and we were on a lovely boat. The Amazon is a fantastic place. I urge you all to go for 3 days and then come home. If you want to completely hedge your bets, go for two. We stayed for 10, and it was a big mistake. However, it was good because I got the whole sense of claustrophobia that I needed for this book. So while we were on the river, that was the first half of the trip, in a beautiful boat, they would take the guests. There were 12 rooms on this boat, and they would put us into skiffs, separate skiffs, and send us out in different directions every day. And there would be 8 people, 10 people on a 15-foot open boat. And we would go for hours and hours in these tiny tributaries where it just forked, and you just keep thinking, this is really going to be bad if the guy who's running the outboard motor has a heart attack. And at one point, we went into a lettuce pond, and one of the guests, who I hadn't met at this point, said, stop the boat. And the guide stopped the boat. And he said, you know, a little to the left, a little to the right, a little back. And he pulls a 15-foot anaconda into the boat. And I'm not afraid of snakes, but I really wanted to get out of that boat. And he proceeded to give us a lecture on anacondas as this anaconda wrapped around him, and he's having this big wrestling match, and he's saying, look in its mouth. You see there are 3 rows of teeth. And by the way, those big things in front, those are teeth and not fangs, because it's not a poisonous snake. It'll just crush you to death. And the whole time, he's wrestling with this thing that only wants to clamp onto his face. The snake's only goal, right here. And he's saying this: the snake has no hinges in its jaws, so it can put my entire torso in its mouth. And this went on for about 20 minutes. And then he unwrapped the snake and he put it back. Anyway, it turns out this guy's name is Greg Greer, and he's a naturalist who lives in Atlanta. And his job has been that he would take a tour group anywhere in the world. There is not an animal, vegetable, mineral, not a bird, not a plant, not a bug on any continent that this man couldn't identify and pick up. Any horrible thing that a sensible person would back away from, Greg Greer was picking it up and showing it to people. And what's great about this whole thing, Greg and I became great friends. And he was a huge resource for me while I was writing this book. For example, when I wrote this scene, okay, I'm going to backtrack for 1 second. I went to the Amazon for Gourmet magazine because Gourmet always sent me everywhere. I loved them very much, like I'm choking just thinking about how much I love them. But the thing that Gourmet was so great at is they knew how to book really obscure trips, which I never was able to figure out. So I wrote this piece for Gourmet, which included the scene of being in a boat and having this guy pull a snake into the boat. And then time goes by, and the piece never ran. And I called my editor, and I said, you know, what happened? Why didn't you run that Amazon piece? It was good. You paid me for it, you know. And he said, did I not tell you about that? He said, oh, the next time that lovely boat that had 12 rooms, the luxury vessel on the Amazon, went out, the boat was taken over by pirates. And they put all of the guests on shore with guns and machetes and left them there. They didn't leave them with guns and machetes. The pirates had guns and machetes. There was poor sentence structure there. So we can no longer promote it as a good tourist destination. And at that moment, I was like, oh, then I get my snake story back, and I get to put it in the book. So I wrote it into the book, and in my version, I had Morena, who is a doctor, killing the snake with a scalpel, because I figured there would be a little medical kit on board the boat, and she would saw the snake apart. And I wrote the whole scene, and then I called Greg to make sure this was right, and he said that would really be like taking your thigh off with an X-Acto knife. You would make it for about 10 seconds, and then you would really need another scalpel. He said, there is a machete on that boat. It is sharp. She has to cut through both rolls of snake at the same time. So Greg is just this lovely, unassuming genius of a snake handler down in Atlanta. And everywhere I go, I wind up talking about Greg because he's such an important part of this book. And I got an email from him last night saying that he had been contacted. Somebody's wife, who was a big Hollywood agent, had heard my talk somewhere, who knows where, and the Hollywood agent had called him and is negotiating for him to have a television show as a snake handler. And he's going to be interviewed on public radio in Minneapolis on Friday. So it's just great karma. It makes me so happy to think, if nothing else, I'm going to bring Greg Greer the national attention he so richly deserves. I know that I'm going to think of a million other things to tell you along the way, but let's go ahead and take a couple of questions, if there are any, or it may be that you all know me so well, you're like, I'll just stop by the house and ask her later. I am so unbelievably sorry that they sold out of books. I'm very grateful that Barnes & Noble came to sell books, and now I would like them to sell more books. Yes. We can do it with the mic, or I can shout out. Either way.
Hi, I'm Kristen House, and I'm a teacher and a writer here in Nashville.
Hey.
And first, I wanted to tell you what an inspiration you are to me as a writer personally. I read Patron Saint when I was 14, and you taught me that writers live everywhere, even in my town.
Sorry. Thank you.
It's emotional for me. Now, I have the honor of teaching teenagers, 11 to 18, to write novels, and it's a great honor. And they have asked me to ask you, what advice would you give to young aspiring novelists, not just writers, but these kids have big dreams and they're writing big books, and they want to know, what would you say to them?
What would I say to young? I think I got an email about you today from Thelma. Is that right?
From Thelma Kidd.
From Thelma Kidd.
My inspiration in the whole world. Yes.
I thought I was your inspiration.
Anyway. You are. did I read somewhere that
we
you
can
also
have more than one inspiration?
That's right. Did I read somewhere also that you also were turned down for a summer job at Davis Kidd?
I was turned down.
Too?
Yes,
yeah, me too.
I was turned down for a summer job at Davis Kidd when I was in college, and now I am rising up like this big monster from the lagoon to have a big bookstore of my own.
I love it.
Okay, what advice would I give to aspiring novelists?
Right.
And all sorts of advice. Number one, read everything. Read critically. Figure out how this book is making you feel the way you feel. Also, write because you understand that you love it, and this is a discipline that you're passionate about. This is not about getting published, especially when you're a teenager. You have to think of it in terms of playing the cello. You have to think about it in terms of something that you're willing to work on because you love the discipline and the craft. Writing is so depressing for people and so hard because we all speak the language. We all know how to operate the keyboard or the pencil. We think in terms of stories. So, you know, everybody comes up and says, I've got a book in my head. My favorite is, I've got a book in my head and I'm really busy. I'd like you to write it. Someone will say it to me tonight, I know. Or maybe I just headed them off at the pass. But I really do think that people have this idea, because we've got the language and we have the technology to get the thought on paper, that we go right to publishing. And if I'm going to write a book, I'm going to be thinking about publishing it. Or if I write a story, I'm going to rewrite it 5 times and then I'm going to send it to the New Yorker. And it's just not about that. If this is what you love and this is what you want to do, then write it. Throw it away, write it, throw it away, write it, throw it away, a million times over. Also know that your pipes are full of junk, and you have to write the junk out. The good stuff is not at the top, it's down deep. You have to, just by the act of writing, you purge and you learn how to do it. So the combination, it's my advice in a nutshell, it's all about volume. You must read such a huge amount, and you must write such a huge amount to find within yourself the stuff that's good.
Thank you. That's exactly what I
want. Yeah, and probably exactly what you've been telling them. So just tell them that that Patchett backs you up all the way. Thank you. Yes. She was wondering, I can do it, if I set the book in Manaus because of the opera house. Yes, because people keep telling me this is the female heart of darkness. That's sort of the one sentence boiled down from critics, which, you know, I'll take that. But actually, it's the female Fitzcarraldo. And my great influence for this book are the films of Werner Herzog, Aguirre, the Wrath of God, which that was the first time a big hand for Werner Herzog, ladies and gentlemen. That was the first time I ever saw The Amazon, was in college when I saw that movie. And Nastasia Kinski getting that arrow right there. Oh, what a moment. Herzog's jungle is much darker than mine, but it's a creepy and disgusting place. And Fitzcarraldo, for those of you who are going to be ordering it up on Netflix tonight, Fitzcarraldo opens at the Opera House in Manaus. And while I did go to the jungle, my plan was to take a second trip to go to Manaus with my friend Renee Fleming, if I may just drop that name in there seamlessly. Renee was going to be singing at that opera house, so I thought, okay, I'll go to Manaus with Renee. And then that trip got canceled, and I was sort of enraged. I kept saying to her, I don't care. You've got to come to Manaus with me anyway. And I wound up never going, and I just watched that opening scene over and over and over again. So, yeah, that's where that comes from. What do I see as the future of publishing for authors, what with the electronic books coming up? Okay, publishing has not gotten on board. We've not been fast enough, and we are going to work it out, and we're going to get on board. And I think it's taking us over like a wave, and we're catching up as fast as we can. The ebook sales and the hardcover sales for this book have been neck and neck. And I am all for people reading on e-readers, because what matters to me is that people read. And I really understand that there are some people, and I am not one of them, who enjoy reading and read more and read with a higher level of comprehension on an e-reader, and that's great. The problem with e-readers in the Amazon model, not the jungle, but the bookseller. Somebody said to me, the Kindle is the Betamax. I loved that. But that you can only buy an electronic book for your Kindle from Amazon. If you use other e-readers, you're going to be able to go to Parnassus Bookstore in Nashville, for example, and buy an e-book for your alternate e-readers. I think that it is really hard for writers who are just breaking in because it totally destroys the shopping model. You have to, if you're downloading a book, pretty much know what you want, read a review, and go and get it. And the problem with a lot of bookstores now is that they're becoming showrooms for e-readers. So I have signed Kindles, and I have signed iPad covers on this tour where people have come up and said, you know, here, would you sign it? And there's nothing wrong with that, except people have got to have enough awareness that they know, I enjoy my e-reader. That's how I like to read my books. But I enjoy going to the bookstore to, you know, participate in a book discussion, to hear an author read, to look around and shop. Bookstore owners keep telling me about people coming in with their iPhones and taking pictures of the books they want to go home and buy. You and people in the overflow room got to have the awareness to say, I am responsible. And if I want my bookstore to survive because I enjoy what it means to my community, then I'm going to have to actually buy some books there. And you can get them a lot cheaper off of Amazon, even in hardback. You can get them a lot cheaper at Costco. And I would like to say, because I love this city so much, and I grew up here, and this is my town. Before my book came out, my friends at the Beveled Edge, where I have been, the frame shop across from Target on Whitebridge Road, where I have been shopping since I was in 10th grade, before it was there, called me up and said, there's not a bookstore. Do you want us to sell your book? And I will go over to the Beveled Edge tomorrow and sign all those books. Also, Stitch It Alterations in Green Hills. And that's what it means to be locally owned and operated. You know that you know your customer and you love them. And when the book came out and there wasn't a bookstore to go to, Stitch It called my mother and said, and I was on tour, we'd really like to sell Anne's book. Can you help us get this lined up? So those are two places I can recommend. It's a crazy changing market, but it really does show you how we rise, and that's beautiful. Yes?
I finished State of Wonder 2 weeks ago in a public place and wept. I had to try to hide my tears, and I won't say to those of you who have yet to read it whether they were tears of joy or sadness.
No, Michael Feldman will do that for you.
Yeah, right. I figured. Well, that may make my question easier. I have had ever since then a question I've been burning to have answered. So I'm going to ask it euphemistically, and maybe you could answer it euphemistically.
If not, we can talk in the line.
Okay. All right. So I had an expectation having to do with bark chewing. That I expected.
Yeah, we can't talk about this.
Right.
No. Can we talk afterwards?
Absolutely.
I look forward to that.
So what I'm interested in is your authorial thinking about how you.
I'll tell you what, though. Let me tell you this about authorial thinking, because this is a nice way to answer the question. I write the book that I want to read. Nobody reads my books while I'm writing them. I don't sell them until I'm finished. I love them passionately, and I'm completely involved. There is a phase after that where I have to read the book about 20 times through different edits, through copy editing, and then proofreading final typeset pages. And by the time that is finished, I don't like the book anymore. There's maybe 2 weeks after the final time I read it, I've never read any of my books again, that I care. And then I break from it completely. And at this point, it is absolutely true that whatever you think about this book is as right or as wrong as anything I think. And I think that the important thing about literary fiction is that it stops at a place where you have enough information to take responsibility. And I don't ever want you to think that I have the right answer. That's the secret author answer that you are supposed to figure out. I give you everything I've got. Then you go forward. I may have my opinion of what happens past the last page of the book, but I would never want to talk about that because it implies that my opinion would be more correct than yours, and that's not true. For example, in Milwaukee last week, a woman stood up and took me down about Magician's Assistant because she said I had portrayed Midwestern women as being mousy and not powerful, and didn't I know Midwestern women were strong and they were fighters? And I said, well, I think it was just one Midwestern family. I don't think it was all Midwestern women. And she said, no, you made a statement about Midwestern women on page 200. And she said, have you ever been to the Midwest? And I said, I used to live in Iowa. And she said, well, then you should know that Iowa women have the highest level of college graduation. And I looked at her and I said, you know, I am sorry. And I hope that I have grown as an author since I wrote that book. But that's 15 years ago since I've looked at it. And I don't have a clue what you're talking about. And even now, you know, even in this short period of time since I've had my emotional break with State of Wonder, and I'm now making up this book in my head, which is so not only so much better than anything I've written, but actually the best book in the history of Western civilization, like I'm there. I'm always there and not there. There you go. Maybe we don't have to talk, but we could. Do you have a question?
I have questions from the other room.
Hi, other room.
Anne, would you want to write a novel about a book club? We have a wonderful group of women in our neighborhood who would like a book about a group like ours. I just finished Run for our group, and we loved it.
I appreciate that. I really appreciate you reading Run, which is this book that's kind of gotten the shaft on book tour. I don't know. It's really funny. People keep introducing me as the author, blah, 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 and they just skip right over that one. But I would say read Karen Joy Fowler's book, The Jane Austen Book Club. She did a great job, and it doesn't need to be done again. Certainly not by me. I actually am a little book club phobic. I have been to so many book clubs as a speaker, and I stopped doing it a long time ago in case you were thinking of asking me, because one week I did 4 book clubs in a week, and I was like, time out, that I'm actually not a member of any book club. If you want to just shout out, I'll repeat.
What did you think of Oprah's book club?
What did I think of Oprah's book club?
And the writer she chose.
And the writer she chose. You know what? Two things. One, I don't under any circumstances watch television, so I've never actually seen Oprah's book club. But I certainly know, you know, who she picked. I bow, truly, with all my heart, I bow at the altar of Oprah, because Oprah got people to read. And she got people to read Dickens, her last two books, Great Expectations and A Tale of Two Cities. Unbelievable. She got people to read that astonishing new translation of Anna Karenina. Yes, she got people to read a lot of junk. But that is the world. That is the world of reading. And I actually watched the Dickens thing. She didn't have on television. She had a blog with Jane Smiley. And you could go, or a podcast or whatever it is. My stepmother sent it to me, and I know Jane Smiley a little bit, and I'm very interested in Dickens. And I watched the podcast of Oprah and Jane Smiley talking about Dickens, and there were people who stood up and said, I have read every single book you told me to read all these years. And I think that what we forget as people who read, there are so many people out there who want to read, and they don't know what to read. And this, again, is a problem that's going to get worse and not better. But we want somebody to recommend a great book to us and put it in our hands. And so I'm going to do that for you tonight. This is also a little sad because these books were supposed to be here, and I've been selling these books like mad all across the country. Now, the name of this book is The All of It. I cannot tell you how many times people have said to me, I read that book, The All of It, as if I was selling Italian manual typewriters. This is 4 words, The all of it. Okay? The author's name is Jeanette Haine, H-A-I-E-N. It is an astonishingly perfect little book, which I have single-handedly put on the Boston Globe bestseller list in the last 3 weeks. I kid you not. I have been selling this book every single night, and here's the story, which proves to you why I am going to be a great bookseller. Last summer, I was vacationing with my dear friend and one of my very favorite writers, Miley Malloy, whose last collection of short stories, Both Ways, is The Only Way I Want It. If you've ever heard of a better titled book, I'd love to know, is fantastic. Miley and I like to go sailing in the summers with our husbands, but our husbands like to sail. Miley and I enjoy vomiting over the side of the boat. And every now and then they will put us ashore. And on this day they put us ashore and we went to a used bookstore on Block Island that was about, I don't know, a fourth the size of this stage. And Miley reached into a cardboard box and she pulled out this book, The All of It. And it was mildewed, it was warped, it was disgusting. She bought it for me for 85 cents. She said, this is one of my very favorite books. It was out of print. The author is dead. It had been a HarperCollins book. It was such a beautiful book. I brought it back to HarperCollins. I said, let me write a foreword, give it a new package, and I'll take it on book tour with me. And every night I've been selling out. It's 145 pages. You read it in one sitting. Has anybody here read it back in its old incarnation? Yes? Love that. Oh, well, you're my mother. Oh, God. What a cheap setup that was. And you know, it's so funny because I'm so blinded by the light. I was like, wait a minute. Didn't you give birth to me? Anyway, go out and get a copy. Maybe we can get Stitch It to sell them. Go out and get a copy of The All of It by Jeanette Haine. It's a beautiful book. Yes. Doris Lessing. She wants me to say something about Doris Lessing because she's 90. The problem is I didn't finish it. I'm sorry, and it's not a fault of the book. It was my fault. I'm sorry. But you know, girlfriend, I can throw some books back at you that would embarrass the hell out of you right now because you haven't read them either. Independent People, Haldor Laxness. You want to have a throwdown here? One of my very favorite book about sheep in Iceland. It takes a really big reader to get through that book, and it's my favorite. Hi, Terry. Other questions? Or do you want me to stop? Okay, one more and then people are dying in the other room.
The other room wants to know how you choose who reads your books on CD.
Oh.
They also thank you for all your good writing and P.S. they want to work at your bookstore.
I've had more people say that they would like a job tonight, and also I have emails from people. That will be up to Karen. How do I pick people to read the CDs? This is very funny because I never have picked before. They just have done it. And now they want to impress me. And they sent me, both in the US and the UK, audio files of people auditioning to read the book. And it was so horrible because I can't read my own books. I was trying to listen to the first 10 minutes of this book over and over again. One, I don't care. You know, whoever sounds good to you is good enough for me. And I finally got my agent's assistant to listen. Now, in the U.S., they did send me all these files, and he apparently picked someone. And then at the last minute, Hope Davis said that she could do it. And everybody was very excited. And from what I have heard, she did a very good job. One of the people who was auditioning, bizarrely, was Cynthia Nixon. And because I was a big Sex and the City fan, I thought, oh, I would want Cynthia Nixon to read my book. And she wasn't good. She had this very sort of high, squeaky voice that wasn't good. Is Karen in the room? Karen? She's maybe in. Can she come back in? I just want to like have everybody turn around and say, "This is my partner, Karen." Hi, Karen. Okay, everybody meet Karen. And I just want you to all know, when Davis Kid closed, I decided I really wanted to open a bookstore. And I looked into it, and I realized I was so far out of my league that it was unbelievable. And then I had the very great good fortune to meet Karen. And it was actually Michael Ziebert who put us together. And Karen is a woman with a business plan who knows how many dollars must be generated per square foot. And she knows where to buy cash registers and things like that. And she is so the brains. And I want you all who have been loving me for putting this together to know that I am the person who is behind this woman here. So Karen Hayes. Thank you. I'm going to say one thing about the signing other than, gosh, I'm so sorry there are no more books left. I can't even tell you how sorry I am. I bet I'm really sorrier than you are about it. But this is the way that we are going to do this book signing, and especially in Nashville. This has worked everywhere for me.